Franchising enabled the new fast food chains to expand rapidly by raising the hopes and using the money of small investors. Traditional methods of raising capital were not readily available to the founders of these chains, the high school dropouts and drive-in owners who lacked proper business credentials. Banks were not eager to invest in this new industry, nor was Wall Street. Dunkin' Donuts and Kentucky Fried Chicken were among the first chains to start selling franchises. But it was McDonald's that perfected new franchising techniques, increasing the chain's size while maintaining strict control of its products. Ray Kroc's willingness to be patient, among other things, contributed to McDonald's success. Other chains demanded a large fee up front, sold off the rights to entire territories, and earned money by selling supplies directly to their franchises. Kroc wasn't driven by greed. The initial McDonald's franchising fee was only $950. He seemed much more interested in making a sale than in working out financial details, more eager to expand McDonald's than to make a quick buck. Indeed, during the late 1950s, McDonald's franchisees often earned more money than the company's founder. After selling many of the first franchises to members of his country club, Kroc decided to recruit people who would operate their own restaurants instead of wealthy businessmen who viewed McDonald's as just another investment. Like other charismatic leaders of new faiths, Kroc asked people to give up their former lives and devote themselves fully to McDonald's. To test the commitment of prospective franchisees, he frequently offered them a restaurant far from their homes and forbade them from engaging in other businesses. New franchisees had to start their lives anew with just one McDonald's restaurant. Those who contradicted or ignored Kroc's directives would never get the chance to obtain a second McDonald's. Although Kroc could be dictatorial, he also listened carefully to his franchisees' ideas and complaints. Ronald McDonald, the Big Mac, the Egg McMuffin, and the Filet-O-Fish sandwich were all developed by local franchisees. Kroc was an inspiring, paternalistic figure who looked for people with common sense, guts, and staying power, and a love of hard work. Becoming a successful McDonald's franchisee, he noted, didn't require any unusual aptitude or intellect. Most of all, Kroc wanted loyalty and utter devotion from his franchisees, and in return, he promised to make them rich. While Kroc traveled the country spreading the word about McDonald's, selling new franchises, his business partner, Harry J. Sonneborn, devised an ingenious strategy to ensure the chain's financial success and provide even more control of its franchisees. Instead of earning money by demanding large royalties or selling supplies, the McDonald's Corporation became the landlord for nearly all of its American franchisees. It obtained properties and leased them to franchisees with at least a 40% markup. Disobeying the McDonald's Corporation became tantamount to violating the terms of a lease, behavior that could lead to a franchisee's eviction. Additional rental fees were based on a restaurant's annual revenues. The new franchising strategy proved enormously profitable for the McDonald's Corporation. "We are not basically in the food business," Sonneborn once told a group of Wall Street investors, expressing an unsentimental view of McDonald's that Kroc never endorsed. "We are in the real estate business. The only reason we sell 15-cent hamburgers is because they are the greatest producer of revenue from which our tenants can pay us our rent." In the 1960s and 1970s, McDonald's was much like the Microsoft of the 1990s, creating scores of new millionaires. During a rough period for the McDonald's Corporation when money was still tight, Kroc paid his secretary with stock. June Martino's 10% stake in McDonald's later allowed her to retire and live comfortably at an oceanfront Palm Beach estate. The wealth attained by Kroc's secretary vastly exceeded that of the McDonald brothers, who relinquished their claim to 0.5% of the chain's annual revenues in 1961. After taxes, the sale brought Richard and Mac McDonald about $1 million each. Had the brothers held on to their share of the company's revenues, instead of selling it to Ray Kroc, the income from it would have reached more than $180 million a year. Kroc's relationship with the McDonalds had been stormy from the outset. He deeply resented the pair, claiming that while he was doing the hard work, grinding it out, grunting and sweating like a galley slave, they were at home, reaping the rewards. His original agreement with the McDonald's gave them a legal right to block any changes in the chain's operating system. Until 1961, the brothers retained ultimate authority over the restaurants which bore their name, a fact that galled Kroc. He had to borrow $2.7 million to buy out the McDonald's. Sonneborn secured financing for the deal from a small group of institutional investors headed by Princeton University. As part of the buyout, the McDonald brothers insisted upon keeping their San Bernardino restaurant, birthplace of the chain. Eventually, I opened a McDonald's across the street from that store, which they had renamed the Big M, Kroc proudly noted in his memoir, and it ran them out of business. The enormous success of McDonald's spawned imitators not only in the fast food industry, but throughout America's retail economy. Franchising proved to be a profitable means of establishing new companies in everything from the auto parts business, Meineke Discount Mufflers, to the weight control business, Jenny Craig International. Some chains grew through franchised outlets, others through company-owned stores, and McDonald's eventually expanded through both. In the long run, the type of financing used to grow a company proved less crucial than other aspects of the McDonald's business model. The emphasis on simplicity and uniformity, the ability to replicate the same retail environment at many locations. As franchises and chain stores opened across the United States, driving along a retail strip became a shopping experience much like strolling down the aisle of a supermarket. Instead of pulling something off the shelf, you pulled into a driveway. The distinctive architecture of each chain became its packaging, as strictly protected by copyright law as the designs on a box of soap. The McDonald's Corporation led the way in the standardization of America's retail environments, rigorously controlling the appearance of its restaurants inside and out. During the late 1960s, McDonald's began to tear down the restaurants originally designed by Richard McDonald, the buildings with golden arches atop their slanted roofs. The new restaurants had brick walls and mansard roofs. Worried about how customers might react to the switch, the McDonald's Corporation hired Louis Cheskin, a prominent design consultant and psychologist, to help ease the transition. He argued against completely eliminating the golden arches, claiming they had great Freudian importance in the subconscious mind of consumers. According to Cheskin, the golden arches resembled a pair of large breasts, Mother McDonald's breasts. It made little sense to lose the appeal of that universal and yet somehow all-American symbolism. The company followed Cheskin's advice and retained the golden arches, using them to form the M in McDonald's. Today, it costs about $1.5 million to become a franchisee at Burger King or Carl's Jr. A McDonald's franchisee pays roughly one-third that amount to open a restaurant, since the company owns or holds the lease on the property. Gaining a franchise from a less famous chain, such as Augie's, Buddy's Barbecue, Happy Joe's Pizza and Ice Cream Parlor, The Chicken Shack, Gumby Pizza, Hot Dog on a Stick, or Tippy's Taco House, can cost as little as $50,000. Franchisees often choose a large chain in order to feel secure. Others prefer to invest in a smaller, newer outfit, hoping that chains like Buck's Pizza or K-Bob Steakhouses will become the next McDonald's. Advocates of franchising have long billed it as the safest way of going into business for yourself. The International Franchise Association, IFA, a trade group backed by the large chains, has for years released studies proving that franchisees fare better than independent businessmen. In 1998, an IFA survey claimed that 92% of all franchisees said they were successful. The survey was based on a somewhat limited sample, franchisees who were still in business. Franchisees who'd gone bankrupt were never asked if they felt successful. Timothy Bates, a professor of economics at Wayne State University, believes that the IFA has vastly overstated the benefits of franchising. A study that Bates conducted for a federal loan agency found that within 4 to 5 years of opening, 38.1% of new franchised businesses had failed. The failure rate of new independent businesses during the same period was 6.2% lower. According to another study, 3/4 of the American companies that started selling franchises in 1983 had gone out of business by 1993. In recent years, conflicts between franchisees and franchisors have become much more common. As the American market for fast food grows more saturated, restaurants belonging to the same chain are frequently being put closer to one another. Franchisees call the practice encroachment and angrily oppose it. Their sales go down when another outlet of the same chain opens nearby, drawing away customers. Most franchisers, on the other hand, earn the bulk of their profits from royalties based on total sales, and more restaurants usually means more sales. In 1978, Congress passed the first federal legislation to regulate franchising. At the time, a few chains were operated much like pyramid schemes. They misrepresented potential risks, accepted large fees up front, and bilked millions of dollars from small investors. The FTC now requires chains to provide lengthy disclosure statements that spell out their rules for prospective franchisees. The statements are often 100 pages long, with a lot of small print. Federal law demands full disclosure prior to a sale, but does not regulate how franchises are run thereafter. Once a contract is signed, franchisees are largely on their own. Although franchisees must obey corporate directives, they are not covered by federal laws that protect employees. Although they must provide the investment capital for their businesses, they are not covered by the laws that protect independent businessmen. And although they must purchase all their own supplies, they are not covered by consumer protection laws. It is perfectly legal under federal law for a fast food chain to take kickbacks, known as rebates, from its suppliers, to open a new restaurant next door to an existing franchisee, and to evict a franchisee without giving cause or paying any compensation. According to Susan Kizios, president of the American Franchise Association, the contracts offered by fast food chains often require a franchisee to waive his or her legal right to file complaints under state law, to buy only from approved suppliers, regardless of the price, to sell the restaurant only to a buyer approved by the chain, and to accept termination of the contract for any cause at the discretion of the chain. When a contract is terminated, the franchisee can lose his or her entire investment. Franchisees are sometimes afraid to criticize their chains in public, fearing reprisals such as the denial of additional restaurants, the refusal to renew a franchise contract at the end of its 20-year term, or the immediate termination of an existing contract. Ralston Purina once terminated the contracts of 642 Jack in the Box franchisees, giving them just 30 days to move out. A group of McDonald's franchisees, unhappy with the chain's encroachment on their territories, has formed an organization called Consortium Members Incorporated. The group issues statements through Richard Adams, a former McDonald's franchisee, because its members are reluctant to disclose their names. The franchise agreement that Dave Feimster signed in 1984 gave him the exclusive right to open Little Caesars restaurants in the Pueblo area. In addition to the franchise fee, he had to promise the company 5% of his annual revenues and contribute an additional 4% to an advertising pool. Most Little Caesars franchisees have to supply the capital for the purchase or construction of their own restaurants. Since Feimster did not have the money, the company gave him a loan. Before selling a single pizza, he was $200,000 in debt. Although Feimster had spent 4 years in college at Colorado Springs, less than an hour away, he'd never visited Pueblo. He rented a small house near his new restaurant on a block full of steelworkers. It was the sort of neighborhood where he'd grown up. Feimster expected to stay there for just a few months, but wound up living there alone for 6 years, pouring all his energy into his business. He opened the restaurant every morning and closed it at night, made pizzas, delivered pizzas, swept the floors, did whatever needed to be done. His lack of experience in the restaurant business was offset by his skill at getting along with all sorts of different people. When an elderly customer phoned him and complained about the quality of a pizza, Feimster listened patiently and then hired her to handle future customer complaints. It took Feimster 3 years to pay off his initial debt. Today, he owns 5 Little Caesars restaurants, 4 in Pueblo and 1 in the nearby town of Lamar. His annual revenues are about $2.5 million. He earns a good income but lives modestly. When I visited a Colorado Springs restaurant operated by a rival pizza chain, the company flew in a publicist from New York City to accompany me at all times. Feimster gave me free rein to interview his employees in private and to poke around his business for as long as I liked. He says there's nothing to hide. His small office behind the Belmont store, however, is in an advanced state of disarray, crammed with stacks of sagging banker's boxes. While his competitors use highly computerized operating systems that instantaneously display a customer's order on TV monitors in the kitchen, Feimster's restaurants remain firmly planted in the era of ballpoint pens and yellow paper receipts. Feimster has established strong roots in Pueblo. His wife is a schoolteacher, a fifth-generation native of the city. His community work occupies much of his time and doesn't seem driven by publicity needs. He donates money to local charities and gives speeches at local schools. He pays some of the college tuition of his regular employees, so long as they maintain a 3.0 grade average or higher. Despite all the hard work, the future success of Feimster's business is by no means guaranteed. Little Caesars is the nation's fourth largest pizza chain, but has been losing market share since 1992. Hundreds of Little Caesars restaurants have closed. Many of the chain's franchisees, unhappy with the company's management, have formed an independent association. Some franchisees have withheld their contributions to the chain's advertising pool. Feimster feels loyal to the Illich family and to the company that gave him a break, but worries about the reduced spending on ads. Even more worrying is the recent arrival of Papa John's in Pueblo. Papa John's is the fastest-growing pizza chain in the United States, adding about 30 new restaurants every month. In the fall of 1998, Papa John's opened its first unit in Pueblo, and the following year, it opened 3 more. The fate of Dave Feimster's restaurants now depends on how his employees serve his customers at every meal. Rachel Vasquez, the manager of the Belmont Little Caesars, takes her job seriously and does her best to motivate crew members. She's worked for Feimster since 1988. She was 16 at the time, and no one else would hire her. The following year, she bought a car with her earnings. She now makes about $22,000 a year for a 50-hour work week. She also receives health insurance. And Feimster annually contributes a few thousand dollars to her pension fund. Rachel met her husband at this Little Caesars in 1991, when she was a co-manager and he was a trainee. "We made more than pizza," she says, laughing. 14 of Feimster's employees meet at the Belmont store around 7 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. Feimster has tickets to an event called Success at the McNichols Sports Arena in Denver. It starts at 8:15 in the morning, runs until 6 in the evening, and features a dozen guest speakers. including Henry Kissinger, Barbara Bush, and former British Prime Minister John Major. The event is being sponsored by a group called Peter Lowe International, the Success Authority. The tickets cost Feimster $90 each. He's rented a van and given these employees the day off. He doesn't know exactly what to expect, but hopes to provide a day to remember. It seems like an opportunity not to be missed. Feimster wants his young workers to see there's a world out there, a whole world beyond the south side of Pueblo. The parking lot of the McNichols Arena is jammed. The event has been sold out for days. Men and women leave their cars and walk briskly toward the arena. There's a buzz of anticipation. Public figures of this stature don't appear in Denver every week. The arena is filled with 18,000 people, and almost every single one of them is white, clean-cut, and prosperous, though not as prosperous as they'd like. These people want more. Peter Lowe has been staging these large-scale events since 1991. He's a 42-year-old success authority based in Tampa, Florida. In 1984, he quit his job as a computer salesman and organized his first success seminar. The appearance of Ronald Reagan at one of these events soon encouraged other celebrities to endorse Peter Lowe's work. In return, he pays them between $30,000 and $60,000 for a speech, for about half an hour of work. Among those who've recently joined Peter Lowe on stage are George Bush, Oliver North, Barbara Walters, William Bennett, Colin Powell, Charlton Heston, Dr. Joyce Brothers, and Mario Cuomo. Rachel Vasquez can hardly believe that she's sitting among so many people who own their own businesses, among so many executives in suits and ties. The Little Caesars employees have seats just a few yards from the stage. They've never seen anything like this. Though the arena's huge, it seems like these 14 fast food workers from Pueblo can almost reach out and touch the famous people who appear at the podium. You are the elite of America, Brian Tracy, author of The Psychology of Selling, tells the crowd. Say to yourself, I like me, I like me, I like me. He is followed by Henry Kissinger, who tells some foreign policy anecdotes. And then Peter Lowe's attractive wife, Tamara, leads the audience in a dance contest. The winner gets a free trip to Disneyland. Four contestants climb on stage. Dozens of beach balls are tossed into the crowd. The sound system blasts the Beach Boys' Surfin' USA, and 18,000 people start to dance. Barbara Bush is next, arriving to fanfare for the common man, her smile projected onto two gigantic television screens. She tells a story that begins, "We had the whole gang at Kennebunkport." When Peter Lowe arrives, fireworks go off, and multicolored confetti drops from the ceiling. He is a slender, red-haired man in a gray, double-breasted suit. He advises the audience to be cheerful, to train themselves for courage, to feed themselves with optimism, and never quit. He recommends his tape series, Success Talk, on sale at the arena, which promises a monthly interview with one of the most successful people of our time. After a short break, he reveals what is ultimately necessary to achieve success. Lord Jesus, I need you, Peter Lowe asks the crowd to pray. I want you to come into my life and forgive me for the things I've done. Lowe has broken from the Christianity of his parents, a faith that now seems hopelessly out of date. The meek shall no longer inherit the earth. The go-getters will get it and everything that goes with it. The Christ who went among the poor, the sick, the downtrodden, among lepers and prostitutes, clearly had no marketing savvy. He has been transfigured into a latter-day entrepreneur, the greatest superstar salesman of all time, who built a multinational outfit from scratch. Lowe speaks to the crowd about mercy. But the worship of selling and of celebrity infuses his literature, his guest lists, his radio shows, and seminars. Don't network haphazardly, Peter Lowe preaches in his $19.95 Peter Lowe's Success Yearbook. Set goals to meet key people. Imagine yourself talking to them. Plan in advance what questions to ask them. When there is an important person you want to network with, be prepared to say something insightful to them that shows you're aware of their achievements. Everyone loves to receive a present. It's hard to be resistant or standoffish to someone who has just given you a nice gift. Adopt the attitude of a superstar. Smile. A smile tells people you like them, are interested in them. What an appealing message to send. These are the teachings of his gospel, the good news that fills arenas and sells cassettes. As the loudspeakers play the theme song from Chariots of Fire, Low wheels Christopher Reeve on stage. The crowd wildly applauds. Reeve's handsome face is framed by longish gray hair. A respirator tube extends from the back of his blue sweatshirt to a square box on his wheelchair. Reeve describes how it once felt to lie in a hospital bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, alone and unable to move and thinking that daylight would never come. His voice is clear and strong, but he needs to pause for breath after every few words. He thanks the crowd for its support and confesses that their warm response is one reason he appears at these events. It helps to keep his spirits up. He donates the speaking fees to groups that conduct spinal cord research. "I've had to leave the physical world," Reeve says. A stillness falls upon the arena. The place is silent during every pause. "By the time I was 24, I was making millions," he continues. "I was pretty pleased with myself. I was selfish and neglected my family. Since my accident, I've been realizing that success means something quite different." Members of the audience start to weep. "I see people who achieve these conventional goals," he says in a mild, even tone. "None of it matters." His words cut through all the snake oil of the last few hours, calmly and with great precision. Everybody in the arena, no matter how greedy or eager for promotion, all 18,000 of them know deep in their hearts that what Reeve has just said is true, too true. Their latest schemes, their plans to market and subdivide and franchise their way up, whatever the cost, the whole spirit now gripping Colorado vanish in an instant. Men and women up and down the aisles wipe away tears, touched not only by what this famous man has been through, but also by a sudden awareness of something hollow about their own lives, something gnawing and unfulfilled. Moments after Reeve is wheeled off the stage, Jack Grapple, the next speaker, walks up to the microphone and starts his pitch. "Tell me, friends, in your lifetime, have you ever been on a diet?" Why the fries taste good. To reach the J.R. Simplot plant in Aberdeen, Idaho, you drive through downtown Aberdeen, population 2,000, and keep heading north past the half dozen shops on Main Street. Then turn right at the Tiger Hut, an old hamburger stand named after a local high school team, cross the railroad tracks where freight cars are loaded with sugar beets, drive another quarter of a mile, and you're there. It smells like someone's cooking potatoes. The Simplot plant is low and square, clean and neat. The employee parking lot is filled with pickup trucks, and there's a big American flag flying out front. Aberdeen sits in the heart of Bingham County, which grows more potatoes than any other county in Idaho. The Simplot plant runs 24 hours a day, 310 days a year, turning potatoes into French fries. It's a small facility, by industry standards, built in the late 1950s. It processes about 1 million pounds of potatoes a day. Inside the building, a maze of red conveyor belts crisscrosses in and out of machines that wash, sort, peel, slice, blanch, blow-dry, fry, and flash-freeze potatoes. Workers in white coats and hard hats keep everything running smoothly, monitoring the controls, checking the fries for imperfections. Streams of sliced potatoes pour from machines. The place has a cheerful, humble, Eisenhower-era feeling, as though someone's dream of technological progress of better living through frozen food has been fulfilled. Looming over the whole enterprise is the spirit of one man, John Richard Simplot, America's great potato baron, whose seemingly inexhaustible energy and willingness to take risks built an empire based on French fries. By far the most important figure in one of the nation's most conservative states, Simplot displays the contradictory traits that have guided the economic development of the American West. The odd mixture of rugged individualism and a dependence upon public land and resources. In a portrait that hangs above the reception desk at the Aberdeen plant, J.R. Simplot has the sly grin of a gambler who's scored big. Simplot was born in 1909. His family left Dubuque, Iowa the following year and eventually settled in Idaho. The Snake River Reclamation Project was offering cheap water for irrigation, funded by the U.S. government, that would convert the desert of southern Idaho into lush farmland. Simplot's father became a homesteader, obtaining land for free and clearing it with a steel rail dragged between two teams of horses. Simplot grew up working hard on the farm. He rebelled against his domineering father, dropped out of school at the age of 15, and left home. He found work at a potato warehouse in the small town of Declo, Idaho. He sorted potatoes with a shaker sorter, a handheld device, 9 to 10 hours a day for 30 cents an hour. At the boarding house where he rented a room, Simplot met a group of school teachers who were being paid not in cash, but in interest-bearing scrip. Simplot bought the scrip from the teachers for 50 cents on the dollar, and then sold the scrip to a local bank for 90 cents on the dollar. With his earnings, Simplot bought a rifle, an old truck, and 600 hogs for $1 a head. He built a cooker in the desert, stoked it with sagebrush, shot wild horses, skinned them, sold their hides for $2 each, cooked their meat, and fed the horse meat to his hogs through the winter. That spring, J.R. Simplot sold the hogs for $12.50 a head and, at the age of 16, became a potato farmer. The Idaho potato industry was just getting started in the 1920s. The state's altitude, warm days, cool nights, light volcanic soil, and abundance of irrigation water made it an ideal setting for growing russet Burbank potatoes. Simplot leased 160 acres, then bought farm equipment and a team of horses. He learned how to grow potatoes from his landlord, Lindsay Maggart, who raised yields by planting fresh seed every year. In 1928, Simplot and Maggart purchased an electric potato sorter. It seemed a remarkable invention. Simplot began sorting potatoes for his friends and neighbors, but Maggart did not want to share the new device with anyone else. The two men fought over the potato sorter and then agreed to settle who owned it with the flip of a coin. J.R. Simplot won the coin toss, got the sorter, sold all his farm equipment, and started his own business in a potato cellar in Declo. He traveled the Idaho countryside, plugging the rudimentary machine into the nearest available light socket and sorting potatoes for farmers. Soon he was buying and selling potatoes, opening warehouses, forming relationships with commodities brokers nationwide. When J.R. Simplot needed timber for a new warehouse, he and his men would just head down to Yellowstone and chop down some trees. Within a decade, Simplot was the largest shipper of potatoes in the West, operating 33 warehouses in Oregon and Idaho. Simplot also shipped onions. In 1941, he started to wonder why the Burbank Corporation, an outfit in California, was ordering so many of his onions. Simplot went to California and followed one of the company's trucks to a prune orchard in Vacaville, where the Burbank Corporation was using prune dryers to make dehydrated onions. Simplot immediately bought a 6-tunnel prune dryer and set up his own dehydration plant in Caldwell, Idaho. The plant opened on October 8, 1941. 2 months later, the United States entered World War II, and Simplot began selling dehydrated onions to the U.S. Army. It was a profitable arrangement. The dehydrated onion powder, he later recalled, was like gold dust. The J.R. Simplot Dehydrating Company soon perfected a new method for drying potatoes and became one of the principal suppliers of food to the American military during World War II. In 1942, the company had 100 workers at the Caldwell plant. By 1944, it had about 1,200. The Caldwell facility became the largest dehydrating plant in the world. J.R. Simplot used the profits earned as a military contractor to buy potato farms and cattle ranches, to build fertilizer plants and lumber mills, to stake mining claims, and open a huge phosphate mine on the Fort Hall Indian Reservation. By the end of World War II, Simplot was growing his own potatoes, fertilizing them with his own phosphate, processing them at his factories, shipping them in boxes from his lumber yards, and feeding the leftover potato scraps to his cattle. He was 36 years old. After the war, Simplot invested heavily in frozen food technology, betting that it would provide the meals of the future. Clarence Birdseye had patented a number of techniques for flash freezing in the 1920s, but sales of Birdseye's new products were hampered, among other things, by the fact that few American grocery stores and even fewer households owned a freezer. The sales of refrigerators, freezers, and other kitchen appliances soared after World War II. The 1950s soon became the golden age of food processing, in the words of historian Harvey Levenstein, a decade in which one marvelous innovation after another promised to simplify the lives of American housewives. Frozen orange juice, frozen TV dinners, the chicken of tomorrow, potato salad from a package, Cheese Whiz, Jell-O salads, jet-puffed marshmallows, Miracle Whip. Depression-era scarcity gave way to a cornucopia of new foods on the shelves of new suburban supermarkets. Post-war refrigerators came with freezer compartments, and J.R. Simplot thought about the foods that housewives might want to put in them. He assembled a team of chemists, led by Ray Dunlap, to develop a product that seemed to have enormous potential, the frozen French fry. Americans were eating more fries than ever before, and the russet Burbank, with its large size and high starch content, was the perfect potato for frying. Simplot wanted to create an inexpensive frozen fry that tasted just as good as a fresh one. Although Thomas Jefferson had brought the Parisian recipe for pommes frites to the United States in 1802, French fries did not become well known in this country until the 1920s. Americans traditionally ate their potatoes boiled, mashed, or baked. French fries were popularized in the United States by World War I veterans who'd enjoyed them in Europe and by the drive-in restaurants that subsequently arose in the 1930s and 1940s. Fries could be served without a fork or a knife, and they were easy to eat behind the wheel, but they were extremely time-consuming to prepare. Simplot's chemists experimented with various methods for the mass production of French fries, enduring a number of setbacks, learning the hard way that fries will sink to the bottom of a potato chip fryer and then burn. One day, Dunlap walked into J.R. Simplot's office with some frozen fries that had just been reheated. Simplot tasted them, realized the manufacturing problems had been solved, and said, "That's a hell of a thing." J.R. Simplot started selling frozen French fries in 1953. Sales were initially disappointing. Although the frozen fries were pre-cooked and could be baked in an oven, they tasted best when heated in hot oil, limiting their appeal to busy homemakers. Simplot needed to find institutional customers, restaurant owners who'd recognize the tremendous labor-saving benefits of his frozen fries. "The French fry was almost sacrosanct for me," Ray Kroc wrote in his memoir. "Its preparation, a ritual to be followed religiously." The success of Richard and Mac McDonald's hamburger stand had been based as much on the quality of their fries as on the taste of their burgers. The McDonald brothers had devised an elaborate system for making crisp French fries, one that was later improved by the restaurant chain. McDonald's cooked thinly sliced russet Burbanks in special fryers to keep the oil temperature above 325 degrees. As the chain expanded, it became more difficult, and yet all the more important, to maintain the consistency and quality of the fries. J.R. Simplot met with Ray Kroc in 1965. The idea of switching to frozen French fries appealed to Kroc as a means of ensuring uniformity and cutting labor costs. McDonald's obtained its fresh potatoes from about 175 different local suppliers, and crew members spent a great deal of time peeling and slicing potatoes. Simplot offered to build a new factory solely for the manufacture of McDonald's French fries. Kroc agreed to try Simplot's fries, but made no long-term commitment. The deal was sealed with a handshake. McDonald's began to sell J.R. Simplot's frozen French fries the following year. Customers didn't notice any difference in taste, and the reduced cost of using a frozen product made French fries one of the most profitable items on the menu, far more profitable than hamburgers. Simplot quickly became the main supplier of French fries to McDonald's. At the time, McDonald's had about 725 restaurants in the United States. Within a decade, it had more than 3,000. Simplot sold his frozen fries to other restaurant chains, accelerating the growth of the fast food industry and changing the nation's eating habits. Americans have long consumed more potatoes than any other food except dairy products and wheat flour. In 1960, the typical American ate 81 pounds of fresh potatoes and about 4 pounds of frozen French fries. Today, the typical American eats about 49 pounds of fresh potatoes every year and more than 30 pounds of frozen French fries. 90% of those fries are purchased at fast food restaurants. Indeed, French fries have become the most widely sold food service item in the United States. J.R. Simplot, an eighth grade dropout, is now one of the richest men in the United States. His privately held company grows and processes corn, peas, broccoli, avocados, and carrots, as well as potatoes. Feeds and processes cattle, manufactures and distributes fertilizer, mines phosphate and silica, produces oil, ethanol, and natural gas. In 1980, Simplot provided $1 million in startup funds to a couple of engineers working in the basement of a dentist's office in Boise, Idaho. 20 years later, his investment in Micron Technology, a manufacturer of computer memory chips and the largest private employer in Idaho, was worth about $1.5 billion. Simplot is also one of the nation's biggest landowners. "I've been a land hog all my life," Simplot told me, laughing. Altogether, he controls a block of North American land that's bigger than the state of Delaware. He stepped down as the chief executive of his company in 1994, but keeps buying more land and scouting new factories. "Hell, fellow, I'm just an old farmer, got some luck," Simplot said, when I asked about the key to his success. "The only thing I did smart, and just remember this, 99% of people would have sold out when they got their first 25 or 30 million. I didn't sell out. I just hung on." The production of frozen French fries has become an intensely competitive business. Although the J.R. Simplot Company supplies the majority of the French fries that McDonald's sells in the United States, two other fry companies are now larger: Lamb Weston, the nation's leading producer of fries, and McCain, a Canadian firm that became the number two fry company after buying Ore-Ida in 1997. Simplot, Lamb Weston, and McCain now control about 80% of the American market for frozen French fries, having eliminated or acquired most of their smaller rivals. The three French fry giants compete for valuable contracts to supply the fast food chains. Frozen French fries have become a bulk commodity, manufactured in high volumes at a low profit margin. Price differences of just a few pennies a pound can mean the difference between winning or losing a major contract. All of this has greatly benefited the fast food chains, lowering their wholesale costs and making their retail sales of French fries even more profitable. Burger King's assault on the supremacy of the McDonald's French fry, launched in 1997 with a $70 million advertising campaign, was driven in large part by the huge markups that are possible with fries. The fast food companies purchase frozen fries for about 30 cents a pound, reheat them in oil, then sell them for about $6 a pound. Idaho's potato output surpassed Maine's in the late 1950s, owing to the rise of the French fry industry and the productivity gains made by Idaho farmers. Since 1980, the tonnage of potatoes grown in Idaho has almost doubled, while the average yield per acre has risen by nearly 30%. But the extraordinary profits being made from the sale of French fries have barely trickled down to the farmers. Paul Patterson, an extension professor of agricultural economics at the University of Idaho, describes the current market for potatoes as an oligopsony, a market in which a small number of buyers exert power over a large number of sellers. The giant processing companies do their best to drive down the prices offered to potato farmers. The increased productivity of Idaho farmers has lowered prices even further, shifting more of the profits to the processors and the fast food chains. Out of every $1.50 spent on a large order of fries at a fast food restaurant, perhaps 2 cents goes to the farmer who grew the potatoes. Idaho's potato farmers now face enormous pressure to get bigger or get out of the business. Adding more acreage increases total revenues and allows more capital investment, but the risks get bigger too. The latest potato harvesting equipment, bright red, beautiful machines manufactured in Idaho by a company called Spudnik, can now set a farmer back hundreds of thousands of dollars. It costs about $1,500 an acre to grow potatoes in Bingham County. The average potato farmer there, who plants about 400 acres, is more than $500,000 in the hole before selling a single potato. In order to break even, the farmer needs to receive about $5 per hundredweight of potatoes. During the 1996-97 season, potato prices fell as low as $1.50 per hundredweight. That year was a disaster for Idaho potato farmers, perhaps the worst in history. Record harvests nationwide and a flood of cheap imports from Canada created an enormous glut of potatoes. For many farmers, letting potatoes rot in the field would have been more profitable than selling them at such low prices. That was not a viable option, however. Rotting potatoes can damage the land. Prices have recovered since then, but remain unusually low. An Idaho potato farmer's annual income is now largely determined by the weather, the world market, and the whims of the giant processors. "The only thing I can really control," one farmer told me, "is what time I get out of bed in the morning." Over the past 25 years, Idaho has lost about half of its potato farmers. During the same period, the amount of land devoted to potatoes has increased. Family farms are giving way to corporate farms that stretch for thousands of acres. These immense corporate farms are divided into smaller holdings for administrative purposes, and farmers who've been driven off the land are often hired to manage them. The patterns of land ownership in the American West more and more resemble those of rural England. "We've come full circle," says Paul Patterson. "You increasingly find two classes of people in rural Idaho: the people who run the farms and the people who own them." Since the end of World War II, farmers in the United States have been persuaded to adopt one new technology after another, hoping to improve their yields, reduce their costs, and outsell their neighbors. By embracing this industrial model of agriculture, one that focuses narrowly on the level of inputs and outputs, that encourages specialization in just one crop, that relies heavily on chemical fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, advanced harvesting, and irrigation equipment, American farmers have become the most productive farmers on Earth. Every increase in productivity, however, has driven more American farmers off the land, and it has left those who remain beholden to the companies that supply the inputs and the processors that buy the outputs. William Heffernan, a professor of rural sociology at the University of Missouri, says that America's agricultural economy now resembles an hourglass. At the top, there are about 2 million ranchers and farmers. At the bottom, there are 275 million consumers. And at the narrow portion in the middle, there are a dozen or so multinational corporations earning a profit from every transaction. The taste of McDonald's French fries has long been praised by customers, competitors, and even food critics. James Beard loved McDonald's fries. Their distinctive taste does not stem from the type of potatoes that McDonald's buys, the technology that processes them, or the restaurant equipment that fries them. Other chains buy their French fries from the same large processing companies, use russet Burbanks, and have similar fryers in their restaurant kitchens. The taste of a fast food fry is largely determined by the cooking oil. For decades, McDonald's cooked its French fries in a mixture of about 7% cottonseed oil and 93% beef tallow. The mix gave the fries their unique flavor and more saturated beef fat per ounce than a McDonald's hamburger. Amid a barrage of criticism over the amount of cholesterol in their fries, McDonald's switched to pure vegetable oil in 1990. The switch presented the company with an enormous challenge: how to make fries that subtly taste like beef without cooking them in tallow. A look at the ingredients now used in the preparation of McDonald's French fries suggests how the problem was solved. At the end of the list is a seemingly innocuous yet oddly mysterious phrase, natural flavor. The frozen potatoes and the cooking oil at McDonald's both contain natural flavor. That fact helps to explain not only why the fries taste so good, but also why most fast food, indeed most of the food Americans eat today, tastes the way it does. Open your refrigerator, your freezer, your kitchen cupboards, and look at the labels on your food. You'll find natural flavor or artificial flavor in just about every list of ingredients. The similarities between these two broad categories of flavor are far more significant than their differences. Both are man-made additives that give most processed food its taste. The initial purchase of a food item may be driven by its packaging or appearance, but subsequent purchases are determined mainly by its taste. About 90% of the money that Americans spend on food is used to buy processed food. But the canning, freezing, and dehydrating techniques used to process food destroy most of its flavor. Since the end of World War II, a vast industry has arisen in the United States to make processed food palatable. Without this flavor industry, today's fast food industry could not exist. The names of the leading American fast food chains and their best-selling menu items have become famous worldwide, embedded in our popular culture. Few people, however, can name the companies that manufacture fast food's taste. The flavor industry is highly secretive. Its leading companies will not divulge the precise formulas of flavor compounds or the identities of clients. The secrecy is deemed essential for protecting the reputation of beloved brands. The fast food chains, understandably, would like the public to believe that the flavors of their food somehow originate in their restaurant kitchens, not in distant factories run by other firms. The New Jersey Turnpike runs through the heart of the flavor industry, an industrial corridor dotted with refineries and chemical plants. International Flavors and Fragrances, IFF, the world's largest flavor company, has a manufacturing facility off Exit 8A in Dayton, New Jersey. Givaudan, the world's second largest flavor company, has a plant in East Hanover. Harman & Reimer, the largest German flavor company, has a plant in Teterboro, as does Takasoga, the largest Japanese flavor company. Vie Monfils, the largest French flavor company, has a plant in Wayne, Bush Boke Allen is in Montvale, and Heavenly Flavors is in Bayonne. Dozens of companies manufacture flavors in New Jersey industrial parks between Teaneck and South Brunswick. Indeed, the area produces about two-thirds of the flavor additives sold in the United States. The IFF plant in Dayton is a huge pale blue building with a modern office complex attached to the front. It sits in an industrial park, not far from a BASF plastics factory, a Jolly French toast factory, and a plant that manufactures Liz Claiborne cosmetics. Dozens of tractor trailers were parked at the IFF loading dock the afternoon I visited, and a thin cloud of steam floated from the chimney. Before entering the plant, I signed a non-disclosure form, promising not to reveal the brand names of products that contain IFF flavors. The place reminded me of Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Wonderful smells drifted through the hallways. Men and women in neat white lab coats cheerfully went about their work, and hundreds of little glass bottles sat on laboratory tables and shelves. The bottles contained powerful but fragile flavor chemicals, shielded from light by the brown glass and the round plastic caps shut tight. The long chemical names on the little white labels were as mystifying to me as medieval Latin. They were the odd-sounding names of things that would be mixed and poured and turned into new substances, like magic potions. I was not invited to see the manufacturing areas of the IFF plant, where it was thought I might discover trade secrets. Instead, I toured various laboratories and pilot kitchens, where the flavors of well-established brands are tested or adjusted, and where whole new flavors are created. IFF's Snack and Savory Lab is responsible for the flavor of potato chips, corn chips, breads, crackers, breakfast cereals, and pet food. The Confectionery Lab devises the flavor for ice cream, cookies, candies, toothpastes, mouthwashes, and antacids. Everywhere I looked, I saw famous, widely advertised products sitting on laboratory desks and tables. The Beverage Lab is full of brightly colored liquids in clear bottles. It comes up with a flavor for popular soft drinks, sport drinks, bottled teas, and wine coolers, for all-natural juice drinks, organic soy drinks, beers, and malt liquors. In one pilot kitchen, I saw a dapper food technologist, a middle-aged man with an elegant tie beneath his lab coat, carefully preparing a batch of cookies with white frosting and pink and white sprinkles. In another pilot kitchen, I saw a pizza oven, a grill, a milkshake machine, and a French fryer identical to those I'd seen behind the counter at countless fast food restaurants. The aroma of a food can be responsible for as much as 90% of its flavor. Scientists now believe that human beings acquired the sense of taste as a way to avoid being poisoned. Edible plants generally taste sweet, deadly ones, bitter. Taste is supposed to help us differentiate food that's good for us from food that's not. The taste buds on our tongues can detect the presence of half a dozen or so basic tastes, including sweet, sour, bitter, salty, astringent, and umami, a taste discovered by Japanese researchers, a rich and full sense of deliciousness triggered by amino acids in foods such as shellfish, mushrooms, potatoes, and seaweed. Taste buds offer a relatively limited means of detection, however, compared to the human olfactory system, which can perceive thousands of different chemical aromas. Indeed, flavor is primarily the smell of gases being released by the chemicals you've just put in your mouth. The act of drinking, sucking, or chewing a substance releases its volatile gases. They flow out of the mouth and up the nostrils, or up the passageway in the back of the mouth to a thin layer of nerve cells called the olfactory epithelium, located at the base of the nose, right between the eyes. The brain combines the complex smell signals from the epithelium with the simple taste signals from the tongue, assigns a flavor to what's in your mouth, and decides if it's something you want to eat. Babies like sweet tastes and reject bitter ones, We know this because scientists have rubbed various flavors inside the mouths of infants and then recorded their facial reactions.